Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 9, Monday Night Football Edition. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, we didn't get great games Sunday afternoon from the National Football League and the way they put together their schedule. Sunday night, a little bit closer than I think both of us anticipated. But yet again, the NFL fails to disappoint, a bevy of games decided by one score or less.
Key numbers matter, folks. Boy, that was interesting around the three yesterday. Yeah,
there were people that looked to middle and side games that were probably able to buy small islands with the way that some of those games moved, whether it was the Atlanta Falcons, the Minnesota Vikings. I mean, the list goes on and on by getting the best of the number and how important it is. And you saw that manifest completely in just 1 week of action.
So Sunday Night Football, where would you like to start? I know you were trying to line us up for that.
No, I always like to start with the game that we saw most recently. And obviously, you dig into the box score. Anybody who watches, Mike Vrabel continues to keep his team competitive with sorcery. Yet another game where the Tennessee Titans fail to get to 250 yards of offense. They have 49 plays, 229 yards, less than 5 yards per play, 9 first downs, 1 of 11 on third down, 5 of 16 for 67 yards passing, 48 yards come on one pass play, which was the first pass attempt of the game, yet here we are with the Kansas City Chiefs needing overtime to outlast Tennessee. Payne, I'm ready to throw in the towel when it comes to handicapping Tennessee, because everything I've learned from you over the years gets thrown out the window when you talk about Mike Vrabel, the Tennessee Titans, and their regular season performances.
It's wild to watch. And you mentioned Vrabel, Shane Bowen included in that, and I think really just the Titans defense, because they were covering easily despite Malik Willis completing 5 passes all game and none to wide receivers. 22 total yards in the second half and overtime. And I saw this earlier this morning, the gap in completions from Mahomes to Willis, the largest in the Super Bowl era. Willis didn't complete a single pass to a wide receiver. It was all tight ends. Just unreal to watch. And you look at some of those early drives after being down 9-0. 58% of the Titans' yards were on 4 plays. And I just, if I had said to you, hey, the Chiefs defense going to be lights out, hold the Titans to a 28% success rate in the 9 first downs you mentioned, and Patrick Mahomes is going to account for more than 500 total yards, you're thinking this is a blowout. Why even play the game, right? Just pack it in. We saw exactly what we said would unfold on our preview. Said, hey, if Ryan Tannehill gets upgraded, this is going to close 10.4, 10.2, something in that range. And if Malik Willis is the quarterback, it's going to close 14. Malik Willis is the quarterback. Closed 14, but the Titans tightened, right? They did what they do, and they just defy the odds. They do play smart. They play physical. They play fast. They try to intimidate you. They hold the shit out of you in the secondary. It's a Belichick staple that Vrabel's brought with him to Tennessee. They just make you earn every blade of grass, and that's what this game came down to. The Titans were able to get pressure without having to blitz. Mahomes was pressured on 18 dropbacks when facing 4 or fewer rushers. That was a career high, and then you get some good variance. Right, the Chiefs get a stop on 3rd and 5 from the 6, and your best defensive player in Chris Jones lines up offsides. It turns into 7. Kansas City tries to respond the next possession up 9-7, and you get a holding call on Wiley. The defensive end was 12 yards away from making a play on Mahomes. It had zero impact on the play. So instead of 1st and 10 at the Titans 39, it's 3rd and 20, and a play later, the Chiefs are punting. Kelsey can't catch a 2-yard pass. It turns into a pick and 3 points. Harrison Butker leaves 4 points on the field. It was just the Titans style of game. And despite being wildly outplayed from about the 11-minute mark of the second quarter, you never thought Tennessee wouldn't cover that game.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild. You see it week in, week out with the Tennessee Titans, and I can only imagine where money will come in this coming weekend when they take on a rested Denver Broncos side. Monday mornings are all about the good, the bad, and the ugly. In these parts, we'll cover a little bit of injuries with our man Deepak, talk some look-ahead lines, and certainly get to the Monday Night Football game between the Baltimore Ravens and the New Orleans Saints. But Payne, with the good, the bad, and the ugly, after we put a bow on what we saw on Sunday Night Football, I want to start with the good, and then I'll hand the baton off to you. Close games. I know I mentioned it at the top of the show. With one game yet to be completed in Week 9, there have now been 62 games decided by a touchdown, 6 points or less, and 79 games decided by one score, 8 points or less, both the most such games through the first 9 weeks all time. The NFL talks about wanting parity to try and keep fans engaged from Week 1 all the way through Week 18. I know the play hasn't been at an all-time high, but I guess for a lack of a better term, it's been competitive week in and week out.
It's been lots of shitty drama. Yes, and that's why the dogs are certainly barking right now.
Yeah, it's been a big part of it, especially when you look at dogs, double-digit dogs at that. You had the Tennessee Titans get there against the Chiefs. You saw the Houston Texans do everything they could to hang on in a 29-17 loss on Thursday Night Football against the Eagles as well. But there was plenty of good to highlight, and want to give you the floor and the opportunity to pick out some of the things that stood out to you.
Well, let's go with the obvious, speaking of double-digit dogs. We talked Thursday about the Jets taking professional money plus 13, I think, drove it down to 12 at the time we recorded, and ultimately closed as low as 10.5 once Poyer, Matt Milano, and Tre'Davious White were all out. But the biggest question I had coming into the game was, is the Jets defense real or not? And they answered that in spades. I mean, to hold Josh Allen and the Bills to a negative 0.21 EPA per drop back is quite impressive. And of the 24 offenses that played so far this week, that put Josh Allen in Buffalo 19th in drop back EPA. And you look at what Robert Saleh did, and he's been boisterous and animated and told everyone, hey, this thing's going to turn around. Don't jump on the ship once it does. He was fantastic with his game plan, and you could see it unfold. It was basically the Patrick Mahomes game plan from a year ago. The Jets were willing to let Buffalo be efficient on the ground. Jets only blitzed Josh Allen 2 times all game. That was the lowest rate Josh Allen had seen in his career. The Jets did the 2 things to take away the explosives on the back end, and it was just a smart game plan. And after that, we now have a 3-way race in the AFC East here, which makes things interesting down the stretch.
Yeah, pretty wild when you look at the division from top to bottom. All 4 of those teams playing extremely well to this juncture in the season. And a hat tip to those folks and loyal listeners out there who may have gone out on an island and bet the New York Jets over their win total at 5.5. They officially become the first team in the National Football League to cash that number early in the day. The Seattle Seahawks followed it up later with their win against the Arizona Cardinals. You want to talk about what we saw at Soldier Field with a number of key performers exceeding expectations, from Justin Fields to the tandem of wideouts that you guys have donning teal and orange?
It was a fun game to watch, especially with how it transpired. Those are always nice when they're that easy. You can go back to the season preview or even the first 5 or 6 games to start this year. Anytime we talked about the Bears, we kind of banged the table that Justin Fields was better than the coaching staff thought, and that you couldn't run an offense that threw it 20% below expectation on early downs and think you're going to have Justin Fields grow as a quarterback. And it was just this super run-heavy offense the Bears were running the first 5-6 weeks. They just didn't give him a chance to throw on early downs. They didn't put him in position to succeed. And now all of a sudden, Luke Getsy is opening some things up a little more. I don't know what Luke Getsy is long-term when you think about the NFL coaching influencers, right? They're LaFleur and Hackett, and the Packers and Broncos offenses are basically struggle bus right now. But you at least get some glimpses of upside and promise from Justin Fields. And if you look over this 3-game surge where he's been quite good, it's against New England, Dallas, and Miami. I know the latter is a little bit banged up in the secondary, but those 3 defenses that Fields has played average out to about 11th in defensive adjusted efficiency. And over that sample, Justin Fields is QB8 in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation among 36 qualifying quarterbacks. So he's playing quite well. Now, is Justin Fields going to run for 178 yards a game? No, right? He's not going to eclipse 3,000 rushing yards in a season. But
you never know. Anything is possible, Payne. You shouldn't be such a naysayer over there when you break the single game regular season rushing record for a starting quarterback.
My feeling is if Justin Fields runs 15 times a game, he's not going to survive. But this just looks and feels different the last, you know, three games, and the metrics confirm that.
Yeah, the Bears have been dynamic offensively. Finally, well, they've been able to stay inside the number. And you look at what they accomplished there. I mean, I know Justin Fields was a guy that you were high on from a fantasy perspective early in the year if the Bears were going to unleash his legs, and it's paying dividends for anybody that happened to start him this past week against the Dolphins. On the other side, you mentioned a fun game. I mean, the receivers and what Miami is getting out of Tua when healthy, absolutely incredible. Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle combined for a shade less than 2,000 yards so far this season, and are the second pair of teammates to combine for at least 1,900 receiving yards, Payne, in their team's first nine games of a season. You can only hope, if you're a fan of the Miami Dolphins, that the weather gods smile upon them if they have to go on the road to Orchard Park, New York, or Arrowhead in January, because maybe with an offense this explosive, they can do some big things. Joe Mixon, welcome to the 2022 National Football League season. Five total touchdowns. He did his best Tanner Mordecai impression from SMU the day before. In that 42-21 win over Carolina, 22 carries, 153 yards on the ground, four catches for 58 yards and a receiving touchdown. I guess, Payne, all it took was Ja'Marr Chase being out, the Bengals bottoming out against a division four Monday Night Football, to remember they actually have a very capable weapon in their backfield.
Didn't really look good early on in the season, and it wasn't like he was facing a ton of stacked boxes either, and that was the concerning part. Did all the touches add up from a season ago? There was a reason they didn't really play him a bunch on third downs a season ago, and it was ugly to start this season. And then when you look at some of the film, the way he was lining up, his body mannerisms were tipping off plays in the backfield, so it was ugly. Yesterday, got everything right. 3.3 yards over expectation per rush attempt. So it wasn't just great blocking up front. Joe Mixon ran possessed, and really that was a key win for the Cincinnati Bengals. After that Monday night win, you're like, oof, maybe this offense is absolute bubkiss without Ja'Marr Chase. And I'll be candid, with Zach Taylor at the helm, I was a little concerned that he would be able to make the necessary adjustments to get this offense humming again without Ja'Marr Chase. We know he's not the most sophisticated game planner, offensive mind, or play caller. And suddenly when you're like, you see Ja'Marr Chase go down, you're like, boy, I don't know if this guy's capable to flip this around. And it's not like they played some schlub defense in Carolina. Carolina is a well above average defense. Brian Burns and the rest of those guys on that side of the ball have said all the right things. I was surprised to see that effort. And, you know, there's a little bit of a battle there. I know early on in the week, Cincinnati at 6.5 took some money. But once we got to 7.5 and there were some reports about the injuries in the Bengals secondary, the other side got touched up pretty good at 7.5.
Apparently, all that needs to happen for the Bengals offense to hum on all cylinders, you invite a bottom feeder in the NFC South into your building, you're guaranteed to put up four touchdowns in the first 30 minutes of a football game. Very similar to what we saw them do against the Atlanta Falcons. All right, what else we got for the good category before we pivot and have to highlight some of the lackluster performances we saw across the league?
Well, I think this will be the good transition, because I'll let you crap on the hometown Raiders, but I'm going the opposite direction with a positive.
It's about time the Jags find themselves in the positive. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, you think about Jacksonville. They just have not shown an ability to win close games or battle through adversity this season, right? We said this a couple weeks ago. At that point, they were a fringe top 10 team metrically that couldn't close. Now I would say they're about average, but at 2-6, you're down 13 at the half. It's kind of just easy to keep the narrative alive of Jacksonville being a place where free agents sign lucrative deals and then just pack it in. Right? It's easy to lay down. Instead, the complete opposite happened. You get Agnew with the great return out of the break. You could see the sideline, right? They're just looking for something. And they got that jolt of energy. And then when you strip out garbage time, Jacksonville's number one in EPA per play in the second half on offense yesterday. And the guy that we've been waiting to make some plays and earn the number one pick status, 80 1% of Trevor Lawrence's dropbacks in the second half graded successful. Defensively, Jacksonville started getting some pressure on Carr, which we know he hates, and the Raiders, negative 0.42 EPA per play in the second half. All four phases on display in that second half, right? It was a staff that showed they can make some adjustments because we do like that staff. It was a huge upgrade in the offseason. Special teams got going. Offense and defense were major contributors. So kudos to the Jags for me, but I will let you lead us to the bad with the Raiders.
Well, the Jags are so interesting because I know they sit at 3-6, and this may be an outlandish comment for some of our listeners who are beloved Titans fans. The Jags are, for me, the most talented team in the division right now, and I think it goes without saying. Now, do they have enough runway left to maybe close the gap, knowing that they play the Chiefs, have a bye week, and then host the Baltimore Ravens? Could be a little bit of an uphill battle, but if the Tennessee Titans falter at all, there's still two matchups between the Jags and Titans that could allow them to bridge the gap and be a thorn in their side. But yes, you want to talk about taking two to tango? That was the definition of it, because the Raiders put together yet another pathetic second half. A week after they'd been absolutely embarrassed by the New Orleans Saints, and all the buzz going into the game against Jacksonville, we're going to stay on the East Coast, we're going to have team bonding, that was rock bottom, we're going to come out and put together our most complete effort. And honestly, Payne, for the better part of a quarter and a half, it looked like the Raiders were going to go out there and win that game by 4+ scores. They get outscored 17-0 in the second half. Arizona did it to them earlier this year, 29-3 in overtime. They also blew a 17-0 lead at Arrowhead on Monday Night Football. The Raiders' three losses after leading by at least 17 points this season ties the mark for most such losses by any NFL team in league history, and it's only been two other times. And then you have Devontae Adams in the wake of that effort or lack thereof in the second half saying there's no reason why we should be losing games like this, and it's frustrating. If we played for a shitty team, then it's one thing, but that's not what it is. Derek Carr, pretty quiet at the podium. Clearly, there's something fundamentally wrong here, and I'm never one to cast a head coach to the side after just one season, but fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And Josh McDaniels right now better right this ship, or he's going to be one and done in charge of the silver and black.
Already being called for. And listen, held scoreless in six of the last eight quarters as an offensive mind with Derek Carr and Devontae Adams and Hunter Renfrow and Josh Jacobs. It's inexcusable. And we've now had two internal meetings with ownership. You hit it perfectly, right? Vegas stayed on the East Coast last week to negate travel and rid themselves of some of the external noise, a real kumbaya. And it didn't work. And there were no adjustments made at halftime. Derek Carr, 12% success rate on dropbacks in the second half. And this isn't shocking. We said we weren't fond of this hire in the offseason. And I'm going to kind of word my way around this, but it was the same thing I said 23 months ago when an NFC team inquired about our thoughts on McDaniels when he was the leader in the clubhouse for their job. Unfortunately, that organization woke up and went in another direction, and they've started this season like a house on fire.
It's just mind-boggling to me on a variety of fronts. And again, you want to give everybody a runway. You want to give them an opportunity to figure things out. But this is now the second stop along the way for Josh McDaniels. And it's not like Nathaniel Hackett, where it's his first head coaching job. Hackett has been inept on a variety of levels. We know that he gave himself a little bit of an additional lifeline in Denver with the win against the Jacksonville Jaguars. And you bring in a quarterback, albeit a veteran one, learning a new system. You can understand why it takes a little while. This seems to be a completely different animal. Fortunately for the Raiders, they do get the Indianapolis Colts at home. If they lose that game, I mean, the whole thing may implode, and you may as well blow up Allegiant Stadium given the level of play that we've seen from that team. But you talk about the Indianapolis Colts, and Payne, I really struggled to figure out if I should put this in the bad category or the ugly. That may have been the worst football game I've seen in a long, long time, and I know there was a little bit of weather, but there wasn't that much to see two teams combine for 323 yards of offense. The Colts shade more than 2 yards per play. It was the worst in an NFL game this season, but the Patriots, they're not absolved of all guilt. 3.3 yards per play for them. You look at the Colts averaging 1.1 yards per pass, the Pats 3.9. The Colts sacked 9 times, Indianapolis 0-for-14 on third down. You've taught me that you have 14 attempts at third down conversions. We know your offense isn't running well, and when you don't convert any of them, it only gets that much worse. New England, 6-of-17, and the longest scoring drive in the game covered a grand total of 42 yards. I don't know what I saw there. It just wasn't pretty.
enjoyed it thoroughly until there were a couple defensive scores or special team scores that set up.
You know that's a rule, by the way. You know that's a rule for us, by the way. You bet a college football under or an NFL under, you have to factor in there's going to be 7 to 10 points of special teams or defensive scores that we have to navigate around.
Unreal. So we were actually recording this podcast on Monday the 22nd. I looked this up when word broke that Matt Ryan was benched. And it was pitched as Sam Ellinger will be our quarterback for the rest of the season. We kind of shook our head because Indy was only 7 games into the season with a brand new quarterback learning a brand new scheme. And we know that it's typically like the 10-game mark where you start to see that surge a little bit. And there were other areas of concern for the Colts offense. Offensive line wasn't good. Jonathan Taylor was a little bit banged up. We're still kind of searching for that ancillary weapon to Pittman, who's posing as a true number one who really isn't. There's a multitude of things that were going on there offensively. And listen, Sam Ellinger is a good kid. He's a worker. He's tough-nosed. Fantastic college quarterback. Not an NFL quarterback. And the last 2 weeks have proven that. Just like last year proved that, and nothing jumped off the page in either preseasons. And so to switch to Ellinger, I don't know what they were thinking, right? I mean, the Colts offense right now, dead last in EPA per play since they made that switch. Negative 0.39 EPA per play, just 35% of offensive snaps have graded successful. So the only reason the switch makes sense is if it came from ownership. And the Colts finally just said, F it. Like, we can't play free agent quarterback roulette. We need to get someone in the draft. Let's lose some games. Let's keep Matt Ryan healthy so that large portion of his contract next season isn't guaranteed because of injury. And we're focused on the future. It's the only way that that transition makes sense.
What does this team do in terms of new direction? I mean, Frank Reich and Chris Ballard both have to be in the crosshairs of the firing squad, I would think, given the product that we've seen on the field thus far.
It's really interesting because I like both of those men. And I think the way Ballard's built the team is a little bit different than what works in 2022. You've kind of gone a different route at quarterback. You haven't shored up the tackle situation. You haven't shored up the pass game. You haven't shored up the secondary at your cornerback positions. And when you think about the way NFL games are won in 2022, and I guess maybe not this season necessarily, but in general, right, the way we're pushing forward with the evolution of football, he's built the team a little bit differently. And Frank Reich, who we were extremely high on through the first couple of seasons, I don't know what's going on there. The game plans aren't very good. We knew the adjustments lacked a little bit of imagination. We knew he clammed up a little bit late in games, but in terms of generating offense, in terms of being a little bit sophisticated within the scheme and the game plan in the initial script, we liked all that. They were coming out and building leads, and it's just been the complete opposite. So I don't know how many more games you can lose and keep Frank Reich. Ultimately, if they do part ways, I think he's going to be highly coveted, and he'll find a soft landing spot as an offensive coordinator would be my guess. We'll see. But this just isn't good. And that's the hard part of this transition is with a defense like that that's above average and you're playing in the South Division and your schedule in general is relatively easy compared to other AFC teams, are you able to actually tank? And when you flip the switch on the apparent tank, you're one game out of first place in your own division. And even after losing the last 2 games, with the Titans losing last night, you're still not out of the playoff picture. So is there going to be a realization that maybe we go back to Matt Ryan, or maybe this is the full-blown tank?
I mean, somebody should tell Chris Ballard that they can't tank for Victor Wembanyama. I don't think it's going to work out that well for Indianapolis any more than it is for the Utah Jazz through their first 11 games of the season.
What quarterback are you going and getting?
Honestly, you know my assessment. I don't think C.J. Stroud is a day one starter in the NFL. Like what I've seen.
Think about it this way. Think about it from this perspective. Don't even think about the acumen of the quarterbacks. Who are you going to actually get? Like, where are you going to draft? What pieces do you have to move up in the draft that quarterback needy teams that are going to be at the top of that draft aren't going to draft a quarterback?
You know what
how are you getting there?
I mean, is this where we pencil Jimmy Garoppolo into Indianapolis as a logical fit where they can bring in a guy that still has juice left in the tank, not just 1 year left?
You can't do that. That's the reason you got rid of Matt Ryan. That's the reason you benched Matt Ryan, because you didn't want to play quarterback carousel. You didn't want to keep getting the veteran quarterback that cost a bunch of money that wasn't a long-term solution.
Jimmy might be able to give you 2 to 3 years, but yeah, I hear you completely that that obviously the direction they want to go is starting over from scratch, but you mentioned it and where they'll be drafting. And again, I don't know if any of those quarterbacks are transcendent talents that are going to overhaul your entire franchise. None of those guys, at least if they do, it would absolutely stun me, are going to grade out like a Trevor Lawrence or anything along those lines. But hey, look, that's why I sit where I do, and I let smarter people, at least most of the time, try and make personal decisions to figure out what they want their franchise to look like going forward. Other bad that you saw before we pivot, albeit briefly, to the ugly category.
I think you have to include the Packers here. I know it's low-hanging fruit, but this was the get-right spot. And we saw sharp money on the Packers from the largest key of -3 out to 4. And you think about all of the external stuff, right? Dome setting with no weather. Perfect conditions. Lazard and Watson were both back. And you get a Lions defense that's dead last in schedule-adjusted efficiency, and you piss down your leg. I mean, 18th out of 24 offenses in EPA per play this week were the Packers. 16th in success rate. Scheme isn't good enough. Not a good enough game plan. Not a good enough quarterback play. Not good enough up front. Not enough weapons. It's across the board a disaster for the Green Bay Packers right now.
I was blown away with their offensive game plan, or lack thereof. I tweeted about it on social. I know the player ultimately got hurt. Go figure. As soon as I mentioned somebody during the course of live action with Aaron Jones, that, I mean, we've been critical of Green Bay and their love affair with A.J. Dillon needing to get his requisite touches. Get the ball to the most dynamic playmaker you have. You saw it pay dividends even in a losing effort against the Buffalo Bills. And Aaron Jones became an afterthought both as a runner and a receiver before he ends up being seen on the sidelines in a walking boot with a potential low ankle sprain. But just one of the more baffling things that are there. And you look at Green Bay defensively, that was the strength of the football team. Ain't going to get much better for Sean Gary is out with a torn ACL, like widely is being speculated. Ugly-wise, pain, and you mentioned low-hanging fruit. I mean, P.J. Walker, it was fun while it lasted, I guess, from the heights of a great performance to some extent against the Atlanta Falcons to going 3 of 10.
Are you making short guy jokes there with low-hanging fruit?
I don't make any. Okay. I don't make any of those kind of things. 3 of 10, though, 9 yards, 2 interceptions, pulled for Baker Mayfield. It might have been his last start. And to throw another wrench into the plans of the Carolina Panthers, earlier today it's announced that they activate Sam Darnold. What a quarterback carousel we have going on in Charlotte, just in time for them to be in prime time on Amazon Prime Video on Thursday night against the Atlanta Falcons.
I mean, aside from the situation, again, where there was some guys banged up in the Bengals secondary, and it caused some sharp money on the Panthers at 7.5, I was a little hesitant, because as much as I like P.J. Walker's story, and I love the attitude of playing with house money and having nothing to lose based upon his career trajectory. And, you know, we had Mahomes tweet last week that PJ had the best throw of the season on that deep ball to DJ Moore. It felt like all of that was putting PJ in a light that shouldn't have been. Because you go back to that Week 8 game against Atlanta, PJ Walker actually had the worst completion percentage above expectation despite throwing for 317 yards. And if you pop on the All-22. The Falcons defense came into that game third worst in the league, and they were missing 3 starters in the secondary on top of that. I mean, Panther receivers were running wide open on every single snap. And PJ Walker wasn't great, even though the yards indicated he was. And even the week before, great win against Tampa. Made some really nice throws. Tampa was missing 3 starters from their secondary as well. And ultimately, that was the hesitation I had. Now, the Bengals' secondary was kind of in shambles themselves, but couldn't do anything with it. The scheme from Lou Anarumo was just too good and just stifled PJ, and he was dead last in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation on the week. If you look at a graph, PJ was so bad, it made Ellinger and Willis look competent yesterday.
That's a scary proposition on a variety of fronts, that's the holy trinity of quarterbacks that we're putting in the same metrics to try and grade them against one another. But yeah, it was hard to watch. I did watch a little bit of that first half, and when I'm not bothering with this anymore. I had seen enough of the PJ Walker experience that there were better ways for me to spend my time during a busy early slate. Anything else that you would classify as ugly for what we've seen thus far in week 9?
I think it will get forgotten about because it required a game-winning touchdown from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But Matthew Stafford and the Rams have real freaking problems. And we've really been at the forefront of this, I think, kind of mentioned in the offseason that just might not feel right. And every time you've posed the question of which is more fixable, the Rams or the Buccaneers, we've kind of gravitated towards Tampa Bay. And the Rams again yesterday, 23% offensive success rate, worst of the week, 1% worse than the Malik Willis-led Titans. And you look at Matthew Stafford. I don't know if this gets to a point in the season, and I'm not sure this is the point, but I would think in the future maybe there's discussions of sitting him down based upon the elbow. I mean, he was quarterback 23 out of 24 in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation so far this week. Nearly 34% of the Rams' total yards came on one play to Cooper Kupp, which was a blown coverage with a miscommunication from a safety who's not a starter. And had it been Antoine Winfield, the play probably doesn't even materialize. The other 54 plays the Rams' offense ran gained 2.5 yards per play. And I've just kind of intimated for a couple of weeks now that I don't think this is fixable. And when you come out of the bye week without any real solutions or fixes, it tells me all I need to know here about the Rams.
You're saying that we should get additional chapters and installments of the John Wolford experience for the Rams over the final couple of weeks of the regular season?
It's too early for that because you have a larger abortion coming to town in the Cliff Kingsbury-led Arizona Cardinals, and it's a division game. But if you get to a situation where, you know, you're 2 games or 3 games out of a playoff picture and it's week 14, you probably have to think about setting down Matthew Stafford and thinking about his future.
Oh, what an ugly, ugly fall from grace for the Los Angeles Rams. We knew there were going to be some problems and some adjustments in the wake of them winning the Lombardi Trophy last year. I'm not sure anybody forecasted that they would fall this far and have an offense that absolutely lacked an identity in every facet of the game other than what Cooper Kupp has been able to produce on a week-in, week-out basis. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast and all things Bet the Board at Bet the Board Pod. And Payne, we can run through these rather quickly. Look ahead line adjustments. We've seen the Buffalo Bills, 9.5-point favorites on the look ahead, now down to 7.5. It did get as low as 7. There was a little bit of buyback. Suffice to say, this is all questions about Josh Allen and the potential dinged up elbow.
Well, not everything. I mean, Minnesota battles back and gets a win, and Buffalo loses outright as a double digit favorite. So that is going to reflect in the marketplace a little bit. And when the look ahead was out, it was kind of under the impression that Tre'Davious White would return, and there were question marks about Poyer and Matt Milano, and those two skewed differently. And yes, Josh Allen's dealing with a little bit of an elbow injury, but it happened the play before he rolled left and threw back across his body 70 yards in the air on the final play. So I don't think it's a massive concern, but all of that together is why we've gone from 9.5 to 7.5. And it was certainly a little bit more worthy of discussion when it was down to 7. But now we've come back off that key number, and we're, you know, yes, the 8 has become more valuable in the modern day NFL with teams smartly going for 2-point conversions when they're down 14. So it has had some influence there. So it's not completely irrelevant. But yes, that's the reason for the 2-point move.
Can we get you to perform your own Kirk Cousins-like hype video like we saw after on the team plane when Minnesota ends up slipping by the Washington Commanders yesterday? Do you think you see that in the Payne Insider future?
I got to tell you, I didn't realize Kirk was that cut up. Looking like a modern-day Todd Furman.
I don't know. Football season has not been kind to me for the most part. I look more like an emaciated human, so we'll have to save the shirtless photos until, you know, February or March and get back to hitting the gym. You keep me on a very rigorous schedule this time of year.
You're so worried about the physique, you missed the jab of age.
Oh, no, I caught that. I chose to dodge and evade, much like Kirk Cousins' elusiveness, not in the pocket of what we saw against the Commanders, but the Kirk Cousins we saw scrambling for a 19-yard touchdown the week before against the Arizona Cardinals.
I have to say, I'm watching the Commanders game, obviously, because we have a substantial bet, and any game that we give out on the podcast, for like, I think we've had this discussion. I could have a massive bet. I could have a small bet. Whatever we give out on the podcast, you end up sweating a little bit more. And so that game's over.
Dead and buried.
I mean, Washington's up 10 points. You get the pick six. Sayonara, suckers. That's an easy win. And the refs take shape and call pass interference. And a couple plays later, you're in a dogfight when Taylor Heinicke overthrows a wide open receiver. And kind of been the summation of this season. We got the cover, +3.5, but boy, that came difficult. We were sweating a game that should have been substantially easier.
I typically don't show emotion. You really can't when you do this as we do week in, week out, not just through football season, but a variety of other sports as well. But when Minnesota lines up to kick the field goal and the penalty gets called for making contact with the center, and the Vikings then have 2 full minutes to try and figure out what the hell they're going to do with it. At the end of the game, Payne, I was honestly ready to send Kevin O'Connell a fruit basket for playing it as smartly as he did. They had no aspirations of scoring a touchdown, and they showed what teams should do in that particular spot, unlike the Cleveland Browns, who score a touchdown. We know how things went against the New York Jets. Obviously, good for our bankroll, but good to see teams buttoned up and execute the way they need to in the final moments of a football game.
It was perfect for us and the listeners because the Vikings got the win, helps the win total. But that is something the Vikings practice. And they talked about it on the broadcast, about they spend like 30 minutes every day doing these situational packages. And it came to fruition. And this is a massive upgrade in coaching staff. And it was part of the reason we really liked Minnesota this season. Is this the best 7-1 team we've ever seen? Absolutely not. My goodness, not. But you were getting some nice variants. They're well coached. And boy, the implementation of Hockenson yesterday. My God, all the speculation was that he was going to have limited packages. And we saw a lot of professional bettors pound some of his unders. And they talked about how, like, the final 36 hours, Hock was basically up all night learning the offense, and suddenly on game day, the packages had expanded a little bit, and he was vital to their offense.
Yeah.
And I don't think they win that game without T.J. Hockenson.
Yeah, he was a big piece. I mean, Justin Jefferson obviously grabs the headlines, but it was T.J. Hockenson doing the dirty work between the 20s. And you mentioned Minnesota at 7-1. There's no doubt that they were due to experience a little bit of late-game regression given how poorly they performed in one-score outcomes last year. But it's all about attention to detail. And in the National Football League, where it's 1, 2, or 3 plays max that can determine wins and losses, you have to be able to go out there and put yourself in a position to win games late. This game is interesting the way the number has moved, because both teams weren't inept yesterday, but in very different fashions and forms. Vegas was a 3.5-point favorite on the look-ahead number against the Indianapolis Colts. This number has ballooned all the way out to the secondary key of 6.
One team didn't have a game this week. The other team didn't think they had a second half to play. And so ultimately, when we look at this game, the Cowboys... You remember the look-ahead line on this in the offseason?
Yeah, on the Oh, you're talking Cowboys-Packers. I mentioned Vegas-Colts. Cowboys-Packers, that game was 4.5 the other way, with Green Bay a 4.5-point favorite.
Gotcha. Okay, I thought that's the game you were talking about. I kind of zoned out here as I look at the basketball screen, get absolutely obliterated. Yes, Colts-Raiders.
I know you're following the steam moves on Air Force and Bowling Green on College Hoops opening night, Payne.
Quinnipiac really caught my attention there.
Beautiful college campus, Colts, in Hamden, Connecticut, by the way. A tremendous male-to-female ratio of about 57 to 43. So for any college students out there in Connecticut, you ever want to go drinking, you can do a lot worse than hanging out in Quinnipiac's campus. But go ahead, I digress.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Hidden gem. Hidden gem in the state of Connecticut. Let's put it that way.
We're going to have to make some trips around the country here to some colleges.
just what we need you doing. Leading seminars in a sorority or fraternity Saturday night at 10 p.m. I can't see what could possibly go wrong from a Bet the Board liability standpoint.
So Colt Raiders, that's the game we're actually talking about. Yes, from 3.5 out to 6, this is very much a byproduct of what the Indianapolis Colts are not. I am a little intrigued here to see where this goes from here. There was actually an appetite for the Colts this past week. Now, there was an underlying better that really kept the screen clean and laid it with the Patriots. But there was a lot of money on the Colts, and that's ultimately why, when the entire world knew that Jonathan Taylor was out, but the market apparently had to adjust on screen and went to 6.5, we saw quite the buyback on the Colts, and ultimately that's why the game closed 4.5. So in my mind, if you are taking 6 with a young quarterback on the road against a Belichick-led defense, you know, the Raiders have been out of town for 2 weeks coming back home, and you know, the line here is 6. So I don't know where this is going to go from here, but certainly the first move has been on the Raiders.
And the game that you got to a little bit prematurely, Dallas from 3-5. You mentioned the Cowboys off of a bye week, Green Bay more banged up. The number this offseason leading up to it was the Green Bay Packers, a 4.5-point favorite, to answer your question.
Yes, and now it's 6 at some of the sharper shops. Like, I mean, I think Dallas has figured this thing out. And, you know, we went under 10.5 wins because we didn't believe in the offense, and I think we were right about that. I don't really like the offense, but the defense has been so GD good that it really hasn't mattered. And you really have a Packers offense here that's struggling. And defensively, when you look at where they're deficient, Cowboys should be able to run the ball pretty well here. I ultimately, you know, the price is going to matter here. I would have to think, if this were to get to 7, that just by nature, we're going to see a little bit of buyback. But we're quite happy with the preseason position.
I would echo those same sentiments. One that actually paid dividends, a preseason position against the Packers this past week as well. I wasn't quite sure we were going to get there, but the luxury of having betted early tied up the assets and were able to cash accordingly. Last, as far as look ahead, I think the most fascinating game of this week, and maybe that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, a battle for bragging rights in the state of California between the 49ers and the Los Angeles Chargers. The 49ers were a 4-point favorite on the look ahead. This number out to 7, the Chargers actually exceeded oddsmakers' expectations against the Atlanta Falcons. They win that game by a field goal, and the sharpest of the sharp guys were taking 3. The game was set up, driven up to 3.5 early in the week, but it was the Chargers erasing a double-digit deficit, looked inept stopping the run yet again, but were able to overcome it.
Yeah, it was really some interesting line movement. So, initially early in the week, there was a little bit of a setup. I think guys that get their hands on information thought it was real and forward facing, you know, sent that out and caused the market to really get close to going to 3.5. And I understood the sentiment in that off a bye, the expectation that Keenan might return, and really the Chargers have done their best work on the road, but that just wasn't the case. I mean, Atlanta was the professional position. If you chased it and only took 2.5, you know, unfortunate circumstance there. But ultimately, I don't know what's going to get fixed offensively for the Chargers here. I mean, should have been able to run the ball against Atlanta. They couldn't yesterday. 29% success rate. Herbert, under pressure, just a little bit too much. Couple guys banged up again on that Chargers offensive line. And now you get a San Francisco team that had a big win pre-bye. Now you have an extra week for Shanahan to devise some things offensively with Christian McCaffrey and a defense that likely is going to trend substantially healthier. And the Chargers offense that just does not have the punch in terms of explosiveness down the field. And an offensive coordinator that doesn't really stretch the field. And so you're going to play in a box here without being able to protect Justin Herbert. This is why this line has moved substantially. Is this a cue for you to go and lay 7 when the line was 4? Probably not. But you probably are smart to get some 49er teasers in there this week before it ultimately goes to 7.5.
Yeah, all interesting things that kind of factor into a game that you'd love to see both of these teams operating from a position of strength. The 49ers definitely trending to be the much healthier of the two teams. And when you talk about health in the National Football League, we know that injuries are a big part for not only sports bettors, but for fantasy players alike. And things well beyond the scope of comprehension for both Payne and myself and our overall pay grades, we bring in an expert, easy for me to say, in the Dr. Deepak to break things down for us.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chona. Stanford and Harvard trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right. Well, thank you, Todd. I'm pumped to be bringing you your Bet the Board injury report. The list is long, so we will dive right in, starting with Josh Allen. Now, the video on him showed that his elbow got snapped backwards on a strip sack, and it looks like an elbow sprain. It would most commonly have a mild short-term performance impact here. Now, there are a subset of these that can be more severe, but the fact that he was able to really launch that deep ball and it was pretty much on the money to end the game leans us slightly against that more severe outcome. Then we have Aaron Jones. He was seen in a boot after the game. He was jogging to the locker room, and that combined with the video suggests a low ankle sprain. Most commonly, running backs would play through this the following week with about a 10% performance hit. Then we have Mark Andrews. Now, his video from last week plus the Ravens' comments together suggest a moderate AC joint sprain of his shoulder. These average about 2 to 4 weeks out, so there's a solid chance that he comes back right after their week 10 bye. Then we have Romeo Dubs. Now, the video looked pretty concerning for a high ankle sprain. He was seen in crutches and a boot afterwards. There's a pretty low threshold to use a boot on NFL players just to rest the area and help them heal up faster, but crutches imply at least a moderate severity. So moderate severity high ankles are 3 to 4 weeks, more severe ones usually 4 to 6. So we're looking very likely at a multi-week absence here. And then we have Deion Jackson. Now, he looked like he hyperextended his knee, but it was very likely a stable injury since he was running on it on the sidelines afterwards. Based on that, we would lean towards him playing. They will get an MRI very likely on Monday to check if there's any sort of bone bruising or meniscus injury in the knee, and that could prevent things from progressing as planned, but otherwise, we would lean towards Jackson playing next week. And then we have Mike Evans. Now, he re-entered the game with a pad over his ribs. Mike Evans having a rib injury means that this is usually all about pain control, and he's about as tough as it gets, so likely not missing any time. And then we have DeAndre Swift. Now, he's an interesting buy-low proposition in season-long leagues. He's probably looking at 1 to 2 more slow weeks, but data predicts a high likelihood of being back strong by about week 12 on DeAndre Swift. And then we have Ryan Tannehill. Now, he almost played. He was a game time decision and was ruled out this week. But based on that progression and the fact that most ankle sprains for quarterbacks take 2 to 4 weeks, and he'll be at 3 for his next game, we would anticipate him likely to play. Then Darren Waller. Now, another guy who was practicing this week and then ruled out right before the game. His practice progression does suggest that he will play in week 10. Based on the implied severity of the hamstring issue, though, our data projects a moderate, about 15 to 20% performance dip when he initially comes back. And then Jonathan Taylor. Now, injury, of course, has been an up and down year for him. A re-aggravated ankle, unfortunately, is bad news for Jonathan Taylor. Even mild resprains tend to cost at least 2 weeks, so it would be a little bit surprising to see him play before week 11. Then we have Keenan Allen, another issue of re-aggravation. Probably while doing some drills or conditioning, the hamstring is most vulnerable on explosive movements like sprinting. Wide receivers average 4 to 6 weeks once they have these in-season hamstring re-aggravations. With Keenan Allen sustaining his re-injury leading up to week 8, it wouldn't really be surprising to see him out multiple weeks even from here. When he does come back, he'll likely initially be on a snap count and have a high re-injury risk. And then we have Tre'Davious White. Now the Bills are missing him in their secondary, but he's now about 11 months from ACL surgery. Average return takes 10, so it would be reasonable to expect him back pretty soon. Typically though, 12 to 15 months is when players hit that 90% of their pre-injury explosiveness level. Now Tre'Davious White's pretty close to that timeline, so expect a pretty good player when he comes back. And then we have Michael Thomas. Now, he's been criticized in the media for injuries, both handling last year and this year. Unfortunately, Thomas is now out for the year having turf toe surgery. This is not terribly uncommon for turf toe, and it was very likely that they were just trying to get Michael Thomas through this season and see if he could treat it non-operatively, but unfortunately the injury is a little too severe for that, so he's going to shut it down. Most players would come back the following year at just about pre-injury levels, so we do look for a promising start to 2023 for Michael Thomas. And then we have Marshon Lattimore. Now, he's going to be out this week. He hasn't practiced yet. It sounds like he's dealing with a severe core muscle strain, and those types of cases take about 4 to 6 weeks. He's now missed 3 games, so look for Lattimore to be back on the practice field sometime over the next 2 weeks. And that's all we have it for today, so I will kick it back to you.
A laundry list, Payne, of impactful players that are going to be shelved for a variety of different times. I know Deepak mentioned Aaron Jones. He seemed to be optimistic about his availability for the Green Bay Packers. It looks like the MRI came back negative. We saw earlier this Monday morning, Jonathan Taylor nicked up, DeAndre Swift, Mike Evans playing through pain. Keenan Allen, the guy is put together by paper mache and bubblegum at this point in his career. From Deepak's diagnosis, doesn't appear that he's going to be available for a game that we talked about just now between the Chargers and 49ers. And then when you look at the MASH unit that we're going to see on display for the Baltimore Ravens tonight, no Mark Andrews, the Saints banged up in their own right, no Marshon Lattimore again, Michael Thomas out for the year. It really leaves you scratching your head, but more importantly for the Tennessee Titans, I'm not sure after listening to Deepak talk that they should be that optimistic that Ryan Tannehill may actually be available this coming week against the Denver Broncos, despite their best attempts to mask some of their intent at quarterback for what we saw at Arrowhead last night.
Well, I'm not a doctor, and that's why we bring Deepak on, but I do love the transition, and I will say the same thing I said when we broke down the Titans game on Sunday night, is that the injury that Ryan Tannehill has, it's believed to be a 3.5 to 4 week injury, and day 14 was just yesterday, Sunday night against the Chiefs, and day 21 will be this coming Sunday, and so ultimately what you're hearing is this is a protection decision. If Ryan Tannehill can protect himself, he'll be out there. If he can't, it's going to be Malik Willis again.
Always something you're going to want to monitor for now and over the course of the next 6 days until we get to game day. So thanks, Deepak, as always, for some great injury analysis and perspective on when some of your favorite players may return to be able to make an on-field impact. On to the final order of business, tonight's Monday Night Football matchup between the Baltimore Ravens and the New Orleans Saints. You're looking at Baltimore right now, pretty much a 1.5-point road favorite. That number painted across the board. 46.5 your total. The side down from a full field goal, the total down from a peak of 48.5, 49. The Baltimore Ravens, as we've talked about in great detail, despite being 5-3, they're the seventh team since 2000 to hold a 10-point lead in each of their first 8 games of a season. They're the only team with multiple losses. You look at Lamar Jackson, he has been extremely proficient at covering numbers on the road, 18-9-1 against the spread for a 67% success rate, and he's been dynamic when it comes to matching up against NFC teams. But we also, last week at this very time, in the good, the bad, and the ugly, praised the New Orleans Saints, who finally looked like they showed a pulse on the defensive side, an ability to generate pressure, and look like the kind of stop unit that we thought we were going to get all season long. Payne, when you try and assess the Baltimore Ravens offense, the term that we use in the industry is cluster injuries. I know it may be unfamiliar for folks who could be tuning in for the podcast for the first time, but what I mean when I say that is you can get by when you don't have one difference maker. You may be able to get by when you don't don't have two. But in the case of the Baltimore Ravens, I'm not sure they have any difference makers on the offense other than at the quarterback position. And no, I do not mean to sell talented rookie tight end out of Coastal Carolina, Isaiah Likely, short.
And we'll get to him here in a minute. I don't know where this game closes, but it was being intimated to me that the Saints would close a favorite here. And we'll see ultimately if that happens. They started taking some plus three on this game. We're now down to 1.5 across the board. But speaking to the Saints defense against Lamar Jackson and the Ravens offense, it's really interesting because you could see a situation where the Ravens might be able to have some success on the ground. And prior to dominating the Raiders at home, the Saints front seven really hasn't looked anything like prior Dennis Allen defenses. I mean, New Orleans was literally dead last in pressure rate, and they were 31st in allowing yards per rush before first contact leading into that Raider game. And suddenly, you know, the Saints got to Derek Carr in more than 41% of his dropbacks, and the Raiders' run game was held to a negative 0.61 EPA per rush last week. That was the best mark of week eight for any defense. And so, was that real, or was it the Raiders dealing with the flu? Was it the Raiders' offense that we saw in the second half of the Jacksonville game yesterday? I don't know, but it's a little scary from that perspective, but you do wonder what Saints defense we're getting tonight. Now, to your point, it really helps that Baltimore's offense is without Bateman, Andrews, Dobbs, and the Gus Bus. And if you look specific to Bateman, the Ravens were averaging 7.9 yards per play when Bateman was on the field. It's 5.4 without. So from the best offense in the league to below average, I mean, that is a huge loss, specifically when you think about how this Ravens offense is designed, right? We at least need that one core receiver that has to require some safety help so that safety can't cheat into the box and stop our run.
How dare you talk poorly about the upside of capabilities of Devin Duvernay, who could potentially be their number one if DeMarcus Robinson is also hurt?
Nice gadget guy there in Devin Duvernay.
Go Horns. Horns.
Yes, go Horns. That was a good one. You know, so, I mean, you're looking at Lamar. He's going to have to really do most of this tonight. And you have a Saints defense that's played two mobile quarterbacks this year in Mariota and Kyler. Now, they did give up 102 yards combined there on the ground. And we've seen the Saints defense from time to time struggle with mobile quarterbacks. And we know that the Ravens like to be physical at the point of attack with their run game. So, you know, that's what they're going to be stressing, and they kind of are off the mini buy. So some of those guys up front will be a little bit more rejuvenated. And that, again, has been, you know, mostly the issue with the Saints defense is up front. But if you're the Saints, you have to be forcing Lamar to be a pocket passer. And I'm not saying that because, you know, I'm going to go on this long tangent about Lamar not being able to throw from the pocket, but when you're down, you know, your top two pass catchers, that is the far better option of making Lamar a pocket passer without his top two weapons than letting him get going with his legs and allowing Baltimore to be physical at the point of attack with their ground game. You mentioned Likely. He's going to be targeted a bunch. He's going to have a high usage rate. So I think from that perspective, probably will do decently from a just kind of looking at volume. He was responsible for 39% of the Ravens' air yards last week against Tampa, and he didn't even start the damn game. But the one thing the Saints have been fantastic defensively at is defending tight ends. They're top three in both catch rate allowed and yards per target to the tight end position. Okay, so when you're looking at Likely kind of being the only dude there and the Saints being able to defend that specific position quite well, I don't know what that means for this offense. So it really comes down to the Ravens being able to just be more physical and run the ball. And sometimes when that's your only option, it's a little bit easier to defend an offense here.
Yeah, I would tend to say so. Offenses that operate with their top triplets, potentially Isaiah Likely, Kenyon Drake, and DeMarcus Robinson, not exactly leaving their opponents brimming with fear, I guess probably the right term. And when you look at Baltimore, if they can limp through this game, an extended rest for them to try and get their key cogs back and healthy for a stretch run where they clearly are the team to beat. in the AFC North, in my estimation. Now, when you look at Baltimore on the other side of the ball, their pass defense has been less than stellar, but the run defense is ranked fifth in the league and will provide a little bit of a formidable test. They're ranked 28th overall in passing defense, 20th in points allowed. They obviously go out, they bring on Roquan Smith, and the players have had nothing but good things to say about their new acquisition from the Bears. There was a chance, at least I read yesterday, I haven't checked today, that Tyus Bowser could be out there as well, and Mike McDonald spoke glowingly about the flexibility his defense may be afforded with some of those new additions. But at the same time, you're going to be without JPP, Malik Harrison, you know, amongst others, Marcus Peters, anything but 100%. And this is a Saints offense that suddenly looks to be a little bit more dynamic, something I never thought I'd say, with Andy Dalton at the helm, averaging nearly 30 points per game since he took over, a 50% third down conversion rate, a passer rating flirting with 100. But more importantly for the Saints, over the last couple of games, the last four to be specific, they're getting the ball to their top playmaker, that being Alvin Kamara. His 581 yards from scrimmage leads the league. He's got the most touches of any running back since week five. Last week, he finishes the Saints' leading rusher, 62 yards, and receiver, 96 yards, and scored all three of New Orleans' touchdowns, showing his two-way skills. New Orleans offense against the Baltimore defense, Payne, who's got the edge?
I'm sure our listeners will hear about Andy Dalton in prime time and that whole narrative, and listen, maybe there's something to it. I mean, he did struggle against a poor Cardinals defense on a Thursday night, but in totality this season, right, with limited weapons, guys have been in and out of that lineup, banged up. He's exceeded all projections. Dalton right now ninth in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation out of 34 qualifiers. He's graded out the fifth best passer as well. But I think he'll get some help here with some of the guys that you mentioned in Olave and specifically Kamara. The Ravens are actually 25th in schedule-adjusted defensive rush efficiency, and now they don't have Calais Campbell in the middle, and that has really been the strength of the Saints' offense this season, and they're kind of just bordering on being a fringe top-five run offense. Taysom Hill has gotten into the mix now that he's healthy with designed runs, had 10 carries for 61 yards last week, but I think, you know, specific to Kamara, I think he's going to have some success on the ground. I think he's going to be a vital part of their throw game here. And if you look, right, the Ravens, they've given up the fifth most receptions and receiving yards to running back. So I think Kamara is going to play a huge role here. Now, specific to the game and betting, right, in addition to the Ravens injuries on the offensive side that we mentioned with those four key cogs out, why this total has come crashing down from an open of 49 through the key of 47 down to as low as 46 as we're recording this. It looks like the Ravens are going to have some reinforcements on defense. Tyus Bowser does look like he's going to return. David Ajabo looks like he's set to return. All signs are pointing to the newly acquired Roquan Smith getting plenty of reps in the middle of that defense as well. Per Harbaugh, they had a meeting earlier this week outside the facility, and it looked like Roquan was really getting up to speed with this offense. And I think if he's out there, I know he wasn't playing great, but if he can return to past form and it just allows you to use Patrick Queen as a blitzing linebacker, suddenly I think that enhances two positions on your defense. Now, you know, the mechanics of going out and acquiring Roquan Smith, probably not something I would have done, but I think he does at least upgrade that linebacker room minimally. So that is why we are seeing this total absolutely get crushed under, is, you know, the Ravens' offensive injuries, some guys coming back on the defensive side of the ball. The Saints likely to have some success running the ball and chewing some clock here. And Ravens really, offensively, I don't know how much explosiveness they're going to have here. Now, I don't know the right way to currently attack this, and this is kind of the downfall of breaking down games on game day, is that, you know, we've now seen a three-point move through the 47, so I don't know how much value is left in this under.
Can you just tell me that Chris Olave is going to catch 10 balls for 92 yards and have, you know, maybe a pair of touchdowns in a game that the Saints win 21-17?
Not sure if that's going to happen, Buckwheat.
Oh, a man can dream. A man can dream, but alas.
Sal's going to get you this.
You are probably correct. Yep. Cousin Sal probably going to get the best of me. Harrison Butker can't make field goals. Aaron Jones can't do shit. And I'll continue to rant to myself because nobody gives a rat's ass about my fantasy football team. Anything else?
6 points. from Aaron Jones. That was an anomaly this week.
Yeah, I mean, you look at my numbers. I send you the roster. I let you know how things are going. 6 from him, 4 from DJ Moore. The list goes on and on. I mean, it is what it is, I guess. Anything else that you would like to add to your assessment of what we've seen for Week 9 or any other nuggets that you wanted to include for the breakdown of tonight's culmination of yet another week of the National Football League?
I think that's it.
All right.
Big college podcast Wednesday. Back with the NFL on Thursday. Here we go.
Yeah, let's do it. Best
Down
of luck.
The home stretch.
Best of luck to all of you, our loyal listeners. Thank you guys for tuning in each and every week of the season for the National Football League, college football, and all of the other content and productions we have. Encourage all of you, if you haven't already done so, check out Cardboard Chat. We have a couple of episodes out there. I believe episode 4 dropped last week. For those folks that are interested in the sports card and memorabilia space, it is a great alternative investment class. And knowing how passionate all of you are about your favorite teams and players, there's a way to monetize that by doing smartly. Payne does an outstanding job with his co-host, Jesse Craig of PWCC Marketplace. So it's a great way to kind of fill the time there as well. Regardless, best of luck with all of your Saints and Baltimore Ravens investments this evening and wherever the wagering market takes you. Hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.